We hope you enjoy the following presentation of Collective Myths and Individual Development by Leila Rayal. This is the fourth of four audios of a talk given on the morning of September 25, 1983 at the RITA conference in Palo Alto, California. This recording is 23 minutes long. This audio is brought to you by RITA, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Leila Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about RITA or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. And now, Leila Rayal.
So that the idea of becoming is crumbling away to I am, to a larger extent, rather, and identify with that rather than identify with this struggling being trying to get up there, is a limit I've put on myself for at least 25 years. And feeling, as you can be in the space that Rudyard is writing from, in a sense, you experience that larger wholeness. And in a funny way, there's nothing to do, and then you go and do it.
Right. And there is also the struggling and the becoming and the process that's
and then
involved.
You also deal with the question of world peace by seeing it as a larger whole, that then you're not struggling to get it peaceful. You see it in a new way that then others share it. And
That's what I was trying to get at by saying, given a superhuman being who would give, as Alex said very eloquently, different meaning and validity to biological experience, the release of nuclear power on the Earth may look very different, and that kind of thing. Yes, and always, and Alex, thank you very much for that, always the bringing together, that is the central theme. I mean, you can look at it in terms of the cycle, but always the two bringing together by the three, as it were, in Rudyard's work, of here, the ascent of matter, which is our struggling through the cultural matrix, through the process of individualization, toward that higher collectivity, which is as spirit descending toward us with a place, as it were, a quality for each of us to manifest, to create that link. And our responsibility here, it essentially, as where we are, is to build a mind to go through the process of individualization in as constructive a way as possible, giving it a meaning within this larger context so we can incarnate that quality.
Mm-hmm. So that we exist within the new perception, transformed perception, and we exist within that perception rather than striving to understand it as we're individualizing it outside of us, but it's really not, it's just outside our perception.
Yes, we
and
are
when
that.
When we're transformed, we exist within the perception.
Yes. And prayer or meditation.
What was that?
Prayer or meditation is attunement. It's not a wish. Prayer would be attuning to that larger whole. And that has released this tremendous energy. We release the confinement that we normally impose on ourselves. As we meditate or as we pray, we are then allowing that reality to exist, and I think it's very contagious.
It's also that, what I was talking about yesterday, the need. Let me go over here. Yeah, Maggie?
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing when he was discussing prayer about, you know, I think in that shift from, you know, through that process of individual to personal, then it's not something you're reaching outside of yourself. It's prayer becomes an action. It's coming out from you, and then you see you can change. Mm-hmm. It seems like a magical kind of thing.
It is a very magical kind of thing. It's a theurgic sort of thing. And there's a very interesting balance, because here we are, you can change things. And we're back to Rudyard's talk Friday night of transformation, but you can't change anything.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing, where oftentimes what changes is your perspective and your understanding becomes more inclusive so that you see the necessity, again, the need, why something is the way it is in a cyclic process. Now, at this phase, you can accept it and work with it in a constructive way. Or, if that's not the case at that point, there is a kind of calling down of holding energies and powers to bring that into alignment. Yeah.
As I understand the essential root here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the transpersonal realm is the reality. And this illusion that we're in is only reality if we can separate ourselves.
No, from Rajah's point of view, we are not in an illusion. This is real. Reality is what is at this level. And at this level, this is what we're dealing with.
It's only reality if we can separate ourselves from the collective psychism, which is the illusion.
No, the collective psychism is not an illusion. For someone operating within a culture, for example, at the time of the flowering of a culture, that is reality. There's nothing illusory about it. There's no, from Rajah's point of view, there's no reason to do that dual thing of reality, illusion, reality with a capital R and an illusion. That reality is what it is from the particular perspective and level at which you are functioning. And that is reality at that level. When you move to a higher because more inclusive level, as Alex said very beautifully, you give a different meaning and value and you see in a different way experiences of a, quote, lower or less inclusive level. But that still doesn't make it an illusion. I mean, one passes through childhood, but because you're an adult, your childhood is not an illusion. And the stage of childhood, when you're small and, you know, everything in the world is knees, that's not an illusion. Do you see what I mean? It's a stage, and that's what a child reality is. And it is real at that level. But one grows beyond that. One becomes more inclusive. You get taller, you can see more of the room, and then knees take on a different meaning. I don't know. That was what came to my head. You see what I'm saying?
I need you to interpret number 205 of the Sabian Symbol Sense. Because I'll have to show you that.
Okay, let's talk about it later on.
Can I just say, and not only sure. That, from the standpoint of the child, it's actually functionally appropriate. It's healthy that the world is perceived as knees, because if they didn't perceive it correctly, they might get whacked in the head with the knees.
I think the metaphor is becoming less useful when we get into that, but it's that the child needs that child state. And that is psychologically speaking, from an astrological point of view, in those early years when we need to, the ego, the personhood needs to be set as a stable thing. And if that's not, as a foundation, you know, you have a wonky foundation, you build a big tall building, it's liable to fall over one day. So yes, that stage needs to be filled in. But to say, I mean, one can see the value of it. If you have, for example, a people that is not a dynamic people, say, in terms of evolving quickly or changing quickly, let's say. And you've been in a phase of culture where things have remained very beautiful but the same for a long time. And people have become attached to having things the way they are. The culture is kind of ossified. And you want to get people to move to a new level, okay? It might be important and valid to instill in them that what their experience is illusory in relation to this more inclusive view, which they can achieve, that would show them a much more compelling and significant vista. So that to call their reality that they're in then an illusion may serve a purpose. Do you see what I mean? Just as it serves a purpose oftentimes to tell a child, you know, well, I know you feel badly about this, that someone stepped on your toy and whatever, and you'll feel differently about these things when you grow up, or that's not a good example, but something like that, a perspective, that kind of thing. And to realize that at sometimes to set up that duality between this is real and this is an illusion may serve a purpose, because it may spur someone to take a step that they otherwise wouldn't take, to try to detach and decondition from connection to a particular level.
They wouldn't walk out of the cave.
Right. Yes.
So you have to be very careful with this sort of thing when you're doing this, leading him to a different level. If you say your reality is not a reality and this is not the way it's supposed to be and you're all wrong and here's the real world, you're shutting the door right there.
That's right.
You have to reckon with their reality and you have to be aware of their reality before you can affect any kind of change.
Yeah, what I was thinking about, what I was talking there specifically was the movements of culture and religion that tend to talk about one life on Earth, say, as an illusion, and on another plane or another level of experience as real. But it also is true in terms of talking to anyone about their particular worldview, is to tell them that it's an illusion. I don't see that that would serve a purpose at all. Yeah, we're saying the same thing. I was just...
That's a qualitative question, in the sense that if we can remember that we are also that biological mechanism, we can feel the inclusion of all those realities. And when we say there's an illusion, we are with them and not above them in another quality.
Yeah, see, that, and that's not, illusion is just not a word that, for example, I've used, because it, as I've come to think of it through Rudra's work, is that, I mean, illusion, where the word really basically fits is illusion is what we do to ourselves on a personal psychological level when we chase after chimeras, basically, that operates on that. I mean, I would use the word there on that way, but not in a large philosophical or ontological sense. Yes?
Given that the nature of reality is one of those questions that we could just go on and on discussing, and recognizing that such discussion does have some value. So I was wondering if maybe there were some other things that you had intended to share with us before.
Well, one of the things that we were going to do, basically what I was going through was this series of myths. And actually, I plan things in a very strange way, but actually things worked out just the way I planned them, which is to have a loose set of things with the idea that this is what I really wanted to happen, because this is very important. What I was doing, for those of you who wouldn't recognize it, in terms of the myths, I had just gone through and read in Rudra's book, Culture, Crisis, and Creativity, where he lists all these myths, the myth of democracy and the myth of this, and I was using this as a jumping off place to set a tone and to convey some basic ideas about the nature of I and personal reality, the relation between the individual and the lower collectivity, as it were, the culture, and the higher collectivity, and then to have this kind of discussion and interchange. And one thing, there are two things there, and we'll take those two, and then we did also have on the agenda, because most of you wanted to do that, a discussion about Rita. So I think let's try and bring this to a close and do that. Are you going to do that quickly? And then I've got Nikki and Joseph in the back. Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
One question, from the very beginning of your talk, it's about the sociocultural stage. Is the mind then a function of the ego at that stage?
No. Well, yes and no. At the sociocultural level, the mind is the servant of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In that sense. And the mind is like the clever, conniving lawyer's mind that figures out the way to put the ego in the position of safety, security, prestige that it wants to go in. Just as at the biological level, mind operates too, but it's the servants of instincts and the life desires. Okay? Yes, so that's the point, is to separate it from the ego, which is basically controlled by the values and the conditioning of the society, to question those, and then that separates the mind so that the mind can develop as this meeting place for the descent of spirit and the ascent of matter, which is the body, as it were, in the body of the earth and the culture giving rise to the mind.
When the other is an observation, when you mentioned about the questioning intellectually values to which one is bound psychically and emotionally, I find it very interesting to watch children growing up, so children which are about 10, 12 years old, if they're born from parents who went through the late 60s or the early 70s, because those parents rebelled outwardly against many things, but the children somehow must attune to their unconscious, which is what they're still, they're bondage to it, and the children grow up including wanting security and wanting order.
But don't mistake, number one, the parents' rebellion for resolution of those issues. And when rebellion continues, in a sense, it's an indication, or can be an indication, of bondage, of continuing bondage, a non-resolution, a non-freedom from that. And it can also be there that the early years of life, when we are operating primarily at the biological level and the ego is developing, the main thing we are looking for is security and order. Mm-hmm. And that is a necessary kind of thing at that stage of life.
Yeah.
That, and should the psychic environment be chaotic, then you have a child who needs, who searches for and needs order and will go wherever that can be found. Mm-hmm. The opportunity in that, always, the opportunity in what you lack, the opportunity in a psychological complex like that, is not to have to be stuck with the order of the past, but to have the opportunity to create order in a futureward sense, mm-hmm. in a new sense. But you have to go through the lack, and you have to go through a process of getting yourself able to create. You have to, as it were, bring yourself up to zero before you can start, because you start in the hole. Yeah. Nikki? Okay. It is a very powerful one, but when you think about it, you know, what is money? I mean, money started out as barter of useful, necessary things, and then it gets into things like counters, shells, and wampum, and all that. And it's basically a consensus kind of thing also. It's whatever represents value in a society. But basically, money, from Rudyard's point of view, he and I have talked about this, and we have, it's not a disagreement, but I think we look at it slightly differently. Rudyard talks about money as basically the hormones of a society. If you sort of use a biological analogy, is that they send juice to where it's happening. I mean, the hormones that give power to things, according to the society's values. But the money itself is a symbol of social power. It's a symbol of being able to do something in the society that can be seen, admired, appreciated by other people. Essentially, in a sense, that's the functional aspect of money, or that's pushing money to the edge of its function. Where it becomes dysfunctional is when it becomes money for the sake of money. And that's the myth of quantity in our society, that more is better. That more land, more people, more money, more whatever. Now, Rudyard says at the sociocultural level, there's a very interesting thing that happens because, for example, at the biological level, there isn't enough. I mean, you can eat yourself to death, but you can eat yourself, you can eat to the point that you can't eat anymore. You can even have sex to the point that you can't sex anymore. Okay. But there's no end to money. It's totally from that point of view, insatiable. And yet, behind it, it's also insubstantial today. Because money is basically, it's a symbol of trust in a particular system of government, in a particular way of life.
Because it's only that everybody agrees that money is worth what it is, that everything works. And if
right.
Money,
right. Right. If that would happen. Right. If the whole thing would fall apart. And to me, now see, Rudyard sees money as, in a sense, more archetypal than that. Because for him, the idea that money has become this insatiable, the drive for money and the capacity to have money has become this insatiable thing. It's like the body of society is like feverish and the hormones are just running all over the place and they don't care where they go or what kind of activities they start. And that to him is not the fault of money itself, but it's a symptom of the illness of society, of the fact that the society is breaking down. It's sort of in its death fever, as it were, that kind of thing. From my point of view, and he sees that as archetypal, I mean, in that exchange, when you look back at the roots of money, the exchange of products and the circulation of hormones and various fluids in the body is an organic thing and an archetypal thing, that you always have that in some form or another, or you have its equivalent or its correlate or whatever, and that in this case it's just absolutely crazy. I think he's probably right. I mean, in the sense that you always have to have some kind of medium of exchange and some method of circulating energy to capacity to do work. But I don't think that it necessarily always has to be in the form of money or even in the form of something vaguely like what we call money, that the form it takes is largely human created, and that in a sense we haven't realized that we've created this, that we've created a monster that's now terrorizing us all, you know, and that we can in some way, or we're going to have to in some way, discreate it or uncreate it. Yeah, and that it, sure it does, and then that brings us back to the question of optimistic in the long run, pessimistic in the short run, is that if money is so binding a situation in the world, that there are lots of things that many people will agree as humanity or as a society is as desirable to do, we ought to do, we should do. I mean, we could agree on all those things, that if it were possible to feed everybody and clothe and all of these kind of things, that we should do that. And yet, we can't.
Well, we don't.
Well, we can't. I mean, we don't. But no matter how, regardless of how you put that, the monetary system is the way we've created it impedes us or stops us from doing that. And it may be that would have to. Although again, that's the short run pessimistic. That would have to be a great deal of trouble and chaos. And yet, in the long run, that may be the thing that needs to happen. Joseph? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yes.
I wanted to contribute an image that came to me as we were talking about the nature of reality and what is illusion. And Bridger's series of wholeness, concentric circles within each other, suggested to me the image that the individual person starts out with a circle of light that's the size of a flashlight, and that is your awareness. And is that illusion? No, it is light. But then, when you make that flashlight into a more powerful searchlight, you see not only that individual, but you see a whole bunch of people like him or like her, and you go, there are a lot of similarities. They look alike, they dress alike, they talk alike, and if you beam that beam even wider, you see that there are groupings that tend to behave alike, which are the cultural constellations, each of which represent one facet of humanity. And if you go even further, you can see the whole planet included in that circle of light, all of which is reality, all of which simply has different definitions,
right,
different sizes. And the core that I see in life is to perceive what is life by making the circle ever wider and letting that consciousness permeate all your actions.
Yes.
Take that to the two-way type cosmic process, and you're talking about you say, how do you say that, concentric circles, the smaller and then the enlarged. If we put it on a horizontal level, the image I get, if we put it on the vertical level and give rise or give attention to that aspect of it, we get the spiral, which is another kind of powerful symbol that has been mentioned in Rudyard's works.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the idea of bringing down. Well, this is wonderful, and we can go on forever like this. And in a way,
maybe use and read it.
Yes. And in a way, it's interesting. Let's leave things in an open, moving on place, so that when we go on from here after this weekend, we don't have everything all tied up that we finished it and we left it here at Vallombrosa. Take the process with us. Okay?
This is the end of part 4 of 4 audios of Collective Myths and Individual Development by Leila Rael from the 1983 RITA conference. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Rudyard Hill and was brought to you by RITA, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about RITA or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard at www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com.